On the Record on News Talk.
Brought to you by PwC. Great minds think unalike. Different skill sets, diverse opinions, it all adds up to the new equation.
Now, here's a question for you. What's in a name? Because if the two names are Katie and Kitty, then actually there's quite a lot. Because today, as it happens, is the birthday of perhaps the most vilified public figure of the Victorian age in Ireland, one Catherine O'Shea, a name that you might not really recognise until you hear her being described as Kitty O'Shea. And then maybe she rings a couple of bells, because the story of her affair, if you could even now call it actually such a thing, with Charles Stewart Parnell, remains one of the great media circuses of Irish and British history. And you might even say that Kitty O'Shea was perhaps the first person to be the sort of target of tabloid ridicule, given that the controversy happened to coincide with the emergence of a new form of press on these islands. Donald Fallon, I'm sure, has been down at the National Library dusting off all of his old copies of Hello Magazine and VIP, because it probably would have been in both, obviously. Donald, it seems that nobody in these islands was neutral, not only on the issue of the affair and where they stood, but also on their positions about Parnell overall.
Yeah, and it was Punch magazine back then that got people upset, but nothing could divide a dinner table really in kind of late 19th century Ireland quite like the subject of Charles Stewart Parnell, or Parnell as some would have it. And you know, he was an enigma of sorts in kind of politics. The recently departed historian Frank Callanan put it really well. What was so weird about Parnell, he noted that he was the Anglo-Irish at the head of an Irish nationalist movement, a landlord who led a land struggle. You know, he wasn't your typical politician.
Like the Protestant leader of Catholic men.
Exactly. Extraordinary. And, you know, defending Parnell or denouncing Parnell was almost a character trait. You know, people had very, very strong feelings on this matter. James Joyce, who we'll hear a lot about in the week ahead, the centenary of Ulysses, described his own father basically between the lines in A Portrait of the Artist as a Young Man. He writes that his dad was a medical student, an oarsman, a tenor, an amateur actor, a shouting politician, a small landlord, a small investor, a drinker, a good fellow, a storyteller, somebody's secretary, something in a distillery, a tax gatherer, a bankrupt, and a present appraiser of his own past. Brilliant.
That's a summary.
But Joyce forgot one thing about Daddy. His father was very much a Parnellite, you know, and how people felt and how people's parents felt in Joyce's case about Parnell.
Did he almost leave it out because that would have been the controversial bit? Because he'd already added all those other bells and whistles. Oh, he was a drinker, he was an investor, he had some job in a distillery that I can't describe, he was a transponster or something.
And John,
but if you say he's a Parnellite, then suddenly you've lost half the readership.
And John is buried pretty much in the shadow of Parnell in Glasnevin Cemetery today. And I think it really left a great distaste in the mouth of Joyce when it came to the role of the church in Irish society and Irish history, a healthy scepticism towards the press as well. And as Joyce's father saw it, and as many thousands of people in Ireland saw it, Parnell was wrongfully attacked.
Ultimately, a lot of how the story of the affair, and again, I use affair in slightly inverted commas because, as we'll discuss, doesn't really fall into the modern definition of that. But a lot of how it was reported reveals a lot about the broader society of the day and how they, much like today, had this idea of cancel culture and wanting heads to roll.
Yeah, and you know what Wilde said about Victorian society was very true. They knew the price of everything and the value of nothing. And they were, you know, they profess such high values of themselves, such strict morality, especially when it came to the role of women in society, which was basically to look pretty and stay on the sidelines. But they craved, you know, sensationalism, gossip. And this was really to prove the kind of the muddering of a new kind of press, which was committed not only to breaking the news, but as you say, cancelling people, breaking reputation, bringing people down. And this story has been primarily remembered, as the downfall of a man and his career, something that reshaped Irish and British political history. You know, perhaps, and I don't like what ifs in history because things happened the way they happened, but perhaps you could say, you know, The downfall of Parnell, it might have delayed Home Rule, it might have paved the way for the violent situation that emerged between us afterwards too. People talk about the effect it had on Parnell. Very few people, even now, at the remove of far more than a century, even talk about the impact, the toll it took on the mind and public standing of this woman at the centre of it. And that undoubtedly, as we'll get into today, deserves much greater recognition.
Yeah, because if you put all of that at her feet, the fact that there was such violence that followed because we could have had a political solution that ticked most of the boxes, then she comes across not only as something of a temptress, but rather someone, not just a home wrecker, but a nation wrecker, if you want to think of it that way. Just rewind though a little bit. Parnell was important for lots of reasons, including the fact that he rose to prominence so young, but also the fact that the British didn't just see him as being a thorn in their side, but they also respected him and viewed him as actually a worthy adversary.
Yeah, Daniel O'Connell, you know, King Dan, the Liberator, whatever you want to call him, who came before Parnell, was considerably older, you know, when he was in Parliament. Like, Parnell, by comparison, is 45 years of age at the time of his death. So he's a young man in British political life. He carries himself and his cause with the swagger of a young man, of a politician in his prime. And I think his maiden speech in the House of Commons is one of the greatest ever delivered. Why should Ireland be treated as a geographical fragment of England? Ireland is not a geographical fragment, but a nation. Just incredible words. Yeah. And, you know, Asquith, the Prime Minister, would later describe Parnell as one of the great men of the 19th century. He reckoned among the three or four greatest men of the 19th century. Gladstone went one better. Parnell was the most remarkable man I ever met. I do not say the ablest man. I say the most remarkable and the most interesting. He was an intellectual phenomenon. Now, not everyone running around the corridors of Westminster thought he was great. Gladstone's secretary described him quite funnily. He said he was as slippery as an eel, as cunning as a serpent, but he was really good at the business of politics. He was young. And yeah, I think the fact that he was an Anglo-Irish landlord made him, in some way at least, contributed to the idea of him as a very powerful, unlikely Irish leader.
Yeah, I suppose that he was in a nice overlap of a lot of Venn diagrams, where he was Irish but a landlord, he was a rebel or a home ruler, but he was an aristocrat of sorts, and that it kind of then, he ticked a lot of boxes that way. So let's come on then to Kitty O'Shea, or should we say Catherine O'Shea, because actually you'll talk in a minute about the meaning of the word Kitty and how it's actually more loaded than we realise today. She was married on the face of it, but it was more complex than that underneath the surface, because to all intents and purposes, she was really single.
Before Catherine O'Shea, she's Catherine Wood, born in Essex in England, the youngest daughter of an Anglican clergyman. And she marries this guy, Captain William Henry O'Shea, who's a great character, total adventurer, and in time settles on a life of an MP, which for him is relatively calm compared to everything that's come before it. And they have several children, but the marriage becomes something of a marriage of convenience. And again, this harks back to the problems with Victorian society. It doesn't matter if your marriage is unhappy. It matters if people think your marriage is unhappy. You know, appearances are more important than reality to these people. So even though they've drifted apart in a big way, they appear together in public, Catherine and Captain O'Shea, which is important to his political aspirations. You know, when you're an MP, you need the doting wife on your arm. And there's also a question of money in the background, as there often is. You know, Catherine's family and her aunt had plenty of it. And as his biographer puts it, he benefited sufficiently to endure an empty marriage. What a great term, an empty marriage. In the hope of future good fortune through Miss Woods, her aunt's will. So to us today, that seems absolutely bonkers. You know, why would two people continue the pretense of a relationship publicly that was well and truly over romantically?
Other than money,
other than public appearance, and what did the neighbours think of us? So Catherine was not just the wife of an MP. You know, when you dig into her a little bit, she's kind of important in her own right. Her family had strong connections to the Liberal Party of Gladstone. She's a bit of a go-between on occasion between the Liberals and the Irish home rulers. She was not a woman willing to sit at home and do nothing with her time, as some would have willed of a politician's wife.
And just to underline how loveless this relationship was, it wasn't as if Catherine O'Shea was so, you know, put up on the shelf that she was completely off the market, because the way that she talks about meeting Parnell and then how she describes him later is the stuff of great romance, far beyond any kind of a Mills and Boone sort of a thing. It's amazing.
Yeah, she later recalls meeting Parnell for the first time, and it's gooey stuff, you know,
gooey. Wow.
It's the stuff of Valentine's Day, this. In leaning forward to say goodbye, a rose I was wearing fell out on my skirt. He picked it up and, touching it lightly with his lips, placed it in his buttonhole. This rose I found long years afterwards, done up in an envelope with my name and the date among his most private papers, and when he died I laid it upon his heart.
That's lovely.
Yeah.
I mean, like, oh no, yeah, it's gooey, but like, it's genuinely, like, it's very stirring.
It is, isn't it? It is. And they pursued this kind of private romance. She was really good for him in a lot of ways. I mean, she encouraged him even in how he presented himself, because he was a little bit dishevelled, Parnell, at times. One political commentator joked that at times he resembled a cross between Oscar Wilde and a scarecrow, which I think means a kind of a slightly unkempt dandy.
Yeah.
But, you know, Catherine encouraged change there, and he looked a new man. He looked fantastic. And the man that we all call the uncrowned king of Ireland, you know, a bachelor, she called him my king. He called her Queenie in their letters. And you know, it was a clandestine relationship, but they were living together. It produced three daughters, two of whom survived, and they were very much madly and totally in love. That's what comes through.
So presumably, actually, and we'll get on then to the extramarital aspect of all of this, I suppose we're already in there, but if there were already kids on the scene, then I guess the societal presumption would have been that they belonged to the captain and not to the leader of the home ruler types. When it all becomes public then, it's deeply embarrassing, and this even then leads to a sensational bit of gossip about Parnell sneaking out of her house to try and avoid the attentions of the husband.
Yeah, and there's been plenty of gossip in recent years around parliamentarians in Westminster, including the Prime Minister, but nothing can really touch what we're about to hear about Charles Stuart Parnell. It's just extraordinary, and it's so mad. They're living together secretly, and then the catalyst for scandal comes with the passing of Catherine's aunt. And what had been a whisper thing, because remember, there's a will on the way, so there's money involved. And what had been a whisper thing then becomes this public scandal when Captain O'Shea, unhappy with how things have fallen, seeks divorce on Christmas Eve, 1889.
Like, if that isn't the template that EastEnders have been working on decades now, the idea of having like the real scandal. Didn't Dirty Den look for a divorce on Christmas Eve?
The divorce papers are served, and then the credits roll, and you're waiting for the next episode.
Yeah,
and it's soap opera stuff.
And the 1889,
media,
yeah.
The media reveled in this because, you know, society, divorce, even for British society, was still a very, very, very new phenomenon. Mm. So when it goes to court, they end up hearing things. It's unheard of to hear this stuff about the lives of ordinary people. To hear about the life of a leading MP was incredible. A member of the House staff recounts Captain O'Shea returning home when Parnell was in the house and how Captain O'Shea rang the front doorbell. Then minutes after that, Mr. Parnell rang the front doorbell and asked to see Captain O'Shea. Now, remember, he'd been in the house.
Yeah.
Could he have gone down the stairs? No. There was a balcony outside the drawing room. There were two rope fire escapes from the window. This happened three or four times. On these occasions, Parnell did not come down the staircase.
So let's just, because that might be difficult for people to imagine if they're at home listening in. So he was in the house. The man of the house knocks on the door. Parnell uses these rope fire escapes to get down from a balcony, and a couple of minutes later then knocks on the front door asking to see the man of the house by way of a deception to prove that he wasn't already inside the door to begin with.
Oh, hello. You know, yeah. is Captain O'Shea in?
Yeah.
Which is amazing. The idea of the political leader of Irish aspirations sliding down the fire escape to ring the front doorbell as if he's just arrived.
That's magnificent.
I mean, it's a total news. I mean, Boris Johnson is trying his best, but he can't come up with a scandal like that.
No.
I mean, this is a news sensation. And it's most unbecoming, you know, as the Victorians would see it.
Mm.
And, you know, Parnell, he's the Protestant leader of a Catholic people, as you say. I mean, you can't really make that point enough. So he's more vulnerable than most people to these things.
Okay, yeah.
Politically.
Right. Okay.
And the idea of being denounced as immoral or whatever else at home is very strong. So, yeah, this idea of one of the most powerful MPs of the 19th century sliding down the fire escape is just extraordinary.
So all this then being so sensational then maybe leads us to understand, although maybe not to defend, how the story of Catherine O'Shea becomes the public persona of Kitty O'Shea, because this is how she's born. And then it's about Kitty O'Shea, and I use that term in inverted commas, that we hear maybe some of the most disgraceful lines ever uttered in the House of Commons, and then a total assassination by media as well.
Yeah, I think this character that they invent, Kitty O'Shea, in the press and in politics, it's deliberately crafted character assassination, because Kitty to the Victorians, it's basically a slang word, it's something of an insult. And it implies that she's some sort of prostitute. And she becomes a temptress, you know, put into the mix to bring about not only the fall of a man, but a movement. And as new as divorce was to British minds, they were still kind of figuring this thing out. It's a totally alien concept here.
Yeah.
You know, Irish Catholics just could not and would not recognise.
I think it's important, though, to reflect on that, because if we think of, like, Kitty, like the Julia Roberts role in Michael Collins, and we think of Kitty as just, well, it's a short for her name. Kitty is a very low determinant. It basically means that she's some sort of hussy.
Absolutely. And what they say about her in the press would today be libelous. I mean, in one publication, readers are told, tall she was and very fair and radiant with the beauty of strength, but in her eyes there shone at times an awful light, and those whom she lured to kiss her, she subsequently devoured. I mean, this devouring men, you know, this temptress who can devour men. And then you get this anti-Parnell Irish Home Rule MP who speaks in Parliament of an alliance of so-called Irish patriots and approved British prostitutes. I mean, absolutely scandalous. An untruth proved by no one, but that this is on the record of Parliament is absolutely extraordinary.
Which is extraordinary stuff then when you're talking about 1890 and people not having any kind of recourse to defend themselves. Parnell never recovers, but even in time, his reputation manages to rebuild a little bit. Hers never does.
Yeah, it's so sad at the end of Parnell. 45 years of age when he goes in 1891 in the arms of his beloved. 200,000 people come out, by the way, on the streets for his funeral at Glasnevin Cemetery. So it's worth making that point. You know, yeah. In some places, support for him does not wane. There is a section of Irish society who says, Parnell is our man and we stand behind him.
And you think about the population of the country at the time as well. That is a large population of people to turn up for any one event, especially when someone is as divisive at that point as he is.
Incredible. And you make a real political point, you know, by going to a funeral like Parnell's. But when, you know, his career ends in political scandal. Later on, the historians, the political commentators, you know, even the British political class rescue this guy. Like Gladstone says, poor fellow, I do believe firmly that if these divorce proceedings had not taken place, there would be a parliament in Ireland today. I mean, there's an acknowledgement in London that this man had come closer than O'Connell had come to home rule. But there's two people in every relationship, and in this one, popular memory, Parnell is the victim of a temptress. That's how it's seen. And poor Catherine, you know, much more than the press really allowed her to be, and much more than, you know, Victorian society expected a woman in an unhappy marriage to be. History, I think, has been very, very unkind to her. And innocently, I've done it. We all call her Kitty O'Shea. Mm. But I think we owe it to her to call her Catherine. And on her birthday, you know, she's more than worth remembering.
Yes, Kitty, Catherine, O'Shea, Parnell, Wood, whatever name you call her by, born on this day in 1846, and somebody who really had their own travails in their own time. Donald Fallon, thank you for that fascinating stuff as ever. And nicely timely, I think, given everything that's going on. Donald Fallon is the author of Henrietta Street from Tenement to Suburbia, which is about the growth of Dublin's major landmarks through the centuries. And he's also the presenter of the Three Castles Burning podcast as well, which is a podcast about Dublin history, which you'll find anywhere that you get your listening material online.
On the Record on News Talk.
Brought to you by PwC. Great minds think unalike. Different skill sets, diverse opinions, it all adds up to the new equation.